Good morning again, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of more than two dozen lodges around the world dedicated to the cause of universal brotherhood, and that includes sisterhood, that includes all of nature. We just want to make an announcement that we will not be open for the next four Sundays in August, or are there five Sundays in August? We're not sure. But we will not be open, I think it's just four, but we will not be open in August. We're taking a break. That is on Sunday, but we are open on Wednesday evenings all through August. And we're studying the notes of the Bhagavad Gita with references to the Bhagavad Gita, of the actual text. So today's topic is magic, but before we begin that, we need to mention some of the mundane things, which is that this building opens on Sunday at 10:30, and from 10:30 to 11, the book table is open, and you may buy straight-line theosophical literature at cost. We make no profit on it. The meeting begins at 11 promptly and ends at 12 promptly. We are open on Wednesday evenings. The doors open at 5:30, and from 5:30 to 7:30, we have a reference library in the front of the building, and you're welcome to peruse it. And we have various topics on comparative religious studies and math and science and humanities are in there. And there's a volunteer librarian always available for any questions. You may study the part for the evening and a reference, if there's a reference, there usually is. Then the meeting begins at, the book table is also open from 6:30 to 7:30, to slightly before the meeting starts. And the meeting begins at 7:45 and ends promptly at 9 p.m. We wanted to read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists in its entirety today. So we'll do that. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So today the topic is magic, and does everyone have the handout? Okay. We're going to skip around a little bit in the beginning, and then we're going to skip a whole section, and then we're going to complete it. We're going to have two readings. I'll start out with the first reading, and then there'll be a second reader, and then we're going to have some time for discussion, because there's so much material in here that we don't want to lose sight of it. So without further ado, we'll begin. We're going to read most of the first paragraph, skip the second paragraph, and read the first half of the third paragraph if you're trying to follow along. Magic was considered a divine science which led to a participation in the attributes of divinity itself. It unveils the operations of nature, says Philo Judaeus, and leads to the contemplation of celestial powers. In later periods, its abuse and degeneration into sorcery made it an object of general abhorrence. We must therefore deal with it only as it was in the remote past, during those ages when every true religion was based on a knowledge of the occult powers of nature. It was not the sacerdotal class in ancient Persia that established magic, as it is commonly thought, but the Magi, who derived their name from it. The Mobeds, who are the priests of the Parsis, the ancient Gerbers, are named even at the present day Magoi in the dialect of Pelvi. Magic appeared in the world with the earlier races of men. The ancients knew more concerning certain sciences than our modern savants have yet discovered. Reluctant as many are to confess as much, it has been acknowledged by more than one scientist. The degree of scientific knowledge existing in early period of society was much greater than the moderns are willing to admit, says Dr. A. Todd Thompson, the editor of Occult Scientists by Salvritti. But, he adds, it was confined to the temples, carefully veiled from the eyes of the people and opposed only to the priesthood. So, are there any questions at this time on the part? Yes.
Do you have any idea what that means? Carefully veiled from the eyes of the people and opposed only to the priesthood?
Yeah, that it seems like it seems contradictory, and we have been scratching our head over this one.
Oh, good.
Well, in ancient times, the priesthood was a sacred thing. It only degenerated later, you know, about 2,000 years ago, it started to degenerate. So we think maybe he was talking about more modern times being opposed only to the priesthood, but we really don't know. If anyone else has any ideas.
Well, we also wondered, could there be a secondary meaning to oppose? I mean, sometimes we read something and then discover in earlier times it meant the opposite of what we think.
Yes. We don't know. Yes.
I transgressed, and I accidentally read the next sentence.
That's fine.
Where it says, speaking of the Kabbalah, the learned, whatever marks that not only our salvation and wisdom, but our science itself came to us from the Jews. My dilemma here is, according to the Jewish calendar, the entire creation is only 5,700 some years old. And surely this magic is older than 5,700 years. Is there an explanation of how the Jews even interpret that? Or?
Well, the Kabbalah is the secret teachings of the Jews. So it's not for the crowd. It's for the elect. So it doesn't contradict the Kabbalah. It only contradicts the exoteric. Yes?
Well, it's also stated that the Jews got it from the Chaldeans, and the Kabbalah is a part of the secret teaching of that time, so that it was kept secret. by the rabbis.
Right. They did keep it from the crowd. Because as the saying goes, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a complete knowledge, it's it's a dangerous thing.
If I just follow up.
Sure.
How does the 5,700-year-old discrepancy fit in here? Because according to their calendar, you know, we're in the Jewish calendar, we're in the year 5,700 change. This has to be more than 5,700 years old. And is there any explanation by the Jews or anybody else of how that can possibly be?
Well, it's as old as the world is, because there were divine instructors, the rishis, which are mentioned in a part that we're actually skipping. But it was the rishis were the seven primeval sages who taught humanity the arts, the sciences, philosophy. And at one time, this knowledge was commonly known to all. It was only when materialism crept in that we started to go away and worshiping the body as the Atlanteans did, and the Atlanteans got into sorcery as well. So that's when the knowledge was obscured. But this knowledge is as old as this earth is. Yes, sir.
I'm just curious about the priesthood. Did it consist of women too, or was it just male?
There have been the priesthood. Was it consist of women too, or was it just men? There were priestesses in the past. Yes.
Just to go back for a moment on that discrepancy of the dates, we were thinking perhaps it's more like Joseph Campbell's taking the metaphor or the myth for the reality. You know, in the Bible it says a day is like a thousand years, or a thousand years
is like a day.
Is like a day. So perhaps it is actual reality statements that are distorted because they're taken literally instead of a mystical interpretation of something.
Yes, well, we know with the Bible, it's actually a very occult book. And it's when taken literally, it's full of contradictions because we don't have the keys to it. So that's where the trouble comes.
I don't know if this is relevant or not, but the Bhagavad Gita is stated to be around 4,000 years old, at least that much, and the Hebrew calendar, as said, is 5,000 some years, but the Hebraic is on a lunar cycle, which is a little bit shorter than the solar cycle. So that's another way of attracting more years in their calculations. So Bhagavad Gita states that's over 4,000 years old. So I don't know if there's any connection with all of that, but I thought it was interesting.
Okay. Thank you for your contribution. Yeah.
The Gita is actually 5,000 plus, whatever it would be from 1897 to here.
Right.
It's 5,000 plus years old. It's based on the death of Krishna.
We think in 1897 it was 5,102. So if we just add that 115 or so years, then 5,217, but that is still 500 years short of the Jewish calendar, so somebody's wrong. We don't want to blame it on the Jews, though. They've been blamed for enough in the past. Yes?
Well, perhaps it's good for us to finish that paragraph.
Okay, sure.
Why not complete the sentence and tell the reader from whom the Jews got their wisdom? Origen, who had belonged to the Alexandrian school of Platonists, declares that Moses, besides the teaching of the covenant, communicated to them very important secrets from the hidden depths of the law, which I think is what the chairperson was talking about, the hidden depths, the very esoteric knowledge that was imparted to us when we began this cycle, given to the 70 elders. These, he enjoined them to impart only to the persons they found worthy, which has been all through time, God bless you, the mystery schools and the disciples and, you know, those who had made themselves ready to hear that. So it's pointing back and back and back, and it just is it's saying exactly what you said. It's angel.
And we may as well pick up with the next paragraph that we haven't read yet. But actually, why don't we go there, because that's where the whole discussion seems to be heading. So at this time, we'll go with the where it starts with St. Jerome names the Jews of Tiberias.
And forgive our pronunciation of things here. St. Jerome names the Jews of Tiberias and Lydda as the only teachers of the mystical manner of interpretation. Finally, Ennemoser expresses a strong opinion that the writings of Dionysus Areopagita have palpably been grounded on the Jewish Kabbalah. When we take in consideration that the Gnostics, or early Christians, were but the followers of the old Essenes under a new name, this fact is nothing to be wondered at. Professor Melitter gives the Kabbalah its just due. He says the age of inconsequence and shallowness in theology as well as in sciences is past. And since that revolutionary rationalism has left nothing behind but its own emptiness, after having destroyed everything positive, it seems now to be the time to direct our attention anew to that mysterious revelation which is the living spring whence our salvation must come, the mysteries of ancient Israel, which contain all secrets of modern Israel, would be particularly calculated to found the fabric of theology upon its deepest theosophical principles, and to gain a firm basis to all ideal sciences. It would open a new path to the obscure labyrinth of the myths, mysteries, and constitutions of primitive nations. In these traditions alone are contained the system of the schools of the prophets, which the prophet Samuel did not found, but only restored, whose end was no other than to lead the scholars to wisdom and the highest knowledge, and when they had been found worthy, to induct them into deeper mysteries. Classed with these mysteries was magic, which was of a double nature, divine magic and evil magic, or the black art. Each of these is again divisible into two kinds, the active and seeing. In the first, man endeavors to place himself in rapport with the world to learn hidden things. In the latter, he endeavors to gain power over spirits. In the former, to perform good and beneficial acts. In the latter, to do all kinds of diabolical and unnatural deeds.
Okay, we're going to break here because there's so much in this paragraph as well. It gives the definition between what is white and black magic. But there's one thing that's actually it doesn't say, which is the most important difference between white and black magic. And does anyone know what that might be?
Motive
is correct. It can be read, it is the motive is everything, and that's when someone is, the two kinds, the active and the seeing. The active, the man endeavors to place himself in rapport with the world to learn hidden things. And in the latter, the motive would be black magic, where one endeavors to gain power over spirits and to do all kinds of diabolical and unnatural deeds. Yes?
Not to be argumentative, but we assume that the double nature, divine and evil, each is again divisible into two kinds, the active and the seeing. So you have divine magic, active, where you're actually trying to do something, and seeing, where you're just seeing it, or evil magic. So we think that contrast, the first is divine magic, but the latter is the evil magic, not the difference between active and seeing, since they both have that. We struggled with that a long time, and that's why we're bringing it up.
Okay, well, are there any other, we're struggling with that as well. So, yes.
Assuming that one has a benevolent motive for understanding this magic, who's to say that one is ready to understand it? Who's to say that one is ready to even dwell into it?
Well, the saying goes that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. So these are things that we need to be initiated into, these deeper mysteries. It says to induct them into the deeper mysteries. That's another way of saying initiation.
So this cannot be learned from any of the books in this library, then?
No, this would not be in any books in our library. That is for sure. Yes?
Well, we think the seeing magic, we all do have to some degree. We sometimes will sense something about another person, never met them before, and we sense something wonderful, or we sense something difficult for ourselves, not necessarily in them, but in our reaction to them. So we think we do already have this magic, it's just we don't value it or use it as it should be used.
Yes, we do have magic, but if it's selfish and separative, it's black magic. It's mostly unconscious black magic. We're not trying to do evil, but we're lacking in the good qualities. And so there's a vacuum there in the back.
And we think people that have some of these powers now, in many respects, they just happen. They're not really capable of controlling the power that they have. And we know that that's one of the outgrowths from evolution, is that we will be able to control these powers as they develop.
Yes.
Can you help me understand what participation in the attributes of divinity itself means?
Okay. What is participation in the attributes of divinity? Well, we have to think about what divinity is. It's an omnipresent, all-powerful, all-seeing, all-knowing, that we do have that potential within us. We have the same potential within us that divinity has. We are divine. We are not, we're not poor, miserable sinners. We're actually gods in evolution. We are nascent. And magic is something that can be performed for the good of all. Not for one's individual good, not for something that's selfish or self-centered. Magic is a science, actually. It's very scientific. And do you have a follow-up to that, or is that?
Well, I don't really understand, because there's references as to what magic will avail you. Like, for example, you will be able to understand the laws of nature, but it, as it's not. I can't really find a description of what magic is.
Right. It's hidden from us. It's.
Is it the ability to levitate that chair, or is it just the ability to understand something at a deeper level? I don't get the fundamental inference here.
It's mostly to be able to understand nature and to have power over nature as well. Now, to levitate a chair would be a demonstration of the lowest form of magic. That's just something that's kind of a parlor trick. But, for instance, it's often given an example of how both Napoleon and Hitler tried to invade Russia during the winter time, which was very foolish. But they could have been influenced by adepts, magicians, to do so, and it stopped them in their campaigns, and it was beneficent. So that's one example.
I think perhaps when we're talking about participating in the attributes of the divine, you know, if we could consider the divine the absolute about which we know absolutely nothing, it has no attributes. But also, philosophically speaking, we can look at nature. Great nature is the divine in its totality, in the entire environment. We can look at the knowledge of God would be the full knowledge of nature. So what would the attributes be? So many of, if not all of the religions, ancient religions, have different gods that do this and do that, and even Catholic religions, they may not attribute it to gods, but they attribute it to, they'll anthropomorphize the spirit of a saint, and he will have certain forces of nature. So, and in India there's 300 million different gods. They really are assigned a body by the mind of the populace. And it's not wrong to do that, and it's not wrong to give them a name, and it's not wrong to say this minor god does this, because really what they're saying is this aspect of nature. So if we're a microcosm of the macrocosm, then every force in nature is inherent to the human being as well. And so the more that we get to know ourselves, the more we get to know great nature. The more, or said differently, the more we get to know great nature, the more we get to know ourselves. And what we would find then is the extent to which we can control everything within ourselves, all of our own attributes, and the more we learn about our attributes, the more we learn about all of those attributes in nature. Everything has a correspondence from a divine correspondence between great nature and the individual.
As above, so below. As on earth, so in heaven. Yes.
As Epictetus pointed out, every single power or attribute that we consider God to have, we have. We will, we create, we think, we choose, we destroy and make better out of what we've destroyed. We already have all those magical powers, but we just don't consider them magical or spiritual. They're just natural to us. And yet, if you stop and think about it, every time you get up and walk, you are moving how many hundreds of pounds with just a thought?
We don't want to say.
With just a thought. You hear and understand funny things that come out of somebody's mouth. That's magical. So we already have all of that. We just don't value it for what it is, and we don't place its source where we should. We are living powers of divinity.
Indeed, we are living powers of divinity. It's mysterious, but we're doing it unconsciously. So we have to learn how to do it consciously. In the back?
Exactly what I was thinking. And the way that happens is, we practice this, it becomes natural to us, and we're headed in the right direction. We were thinking, what could be more magical? And you can see it on people's faces when a child is born, everyone in the room is stunned. They can't understand this magic that just took place, but they're willing to give over to it. Here's a new child, a new soul that's come back. And then how about you're on the bus and there's someone who's just about to cry, and maybe you go sit next to them and say, how you doing? And before they leave the bus, you've lifted their spirits a little bit. That's magical. That is absolutely magical. And it was right there in front of us. We could do something about it or not. But the more we practice these acts of kindness and compassion and uplifting of those and everything else around us, the more white magic or divine magic will become natural to us. And then, as we said, it has to be recognized.
So we are beings of great power, but we're not using our powers consciously. Sometimes we are, but generally we're not. Yes.
Yeah, but isn't that the crux of the whole thing, is that to become initiated into magic, one has to purify his own nature, his lower nature. That, you know, we are ruled by our appetites, our desires, our lust. All those things keep us bound to the earth. And if we wish to reach higher, we have to control all of our lower nature. And by doing that, we can control other aspects of our nature, but we don't realize at the moment.
Self-control and purifying our nature, it's that's the work we have to do. And we're not going to be given the secrets until we've done the homework. Yes, in the back.
Are we going to be reading the last paragraph?
We are. We're going to be reading. We're going to be reading all of the third page.
Good, because that last sentence at the end puts it all in a nutshell.
The basis of magic.
Yes.
Yes, we're getting there, and we also have the 10 items from Isis Unveiled at the end of the book, half of which deal with magic as well. So we may read a reference or two from here as well. Well, let us begin now. Let us continue our discussion, or rather the readings, with on the third page of the handout at the top, page 243.
In the manuscript commentary of Proclus on magic, he gives the following account. In the same manner as lovers gradually advance from that beauty which is apparent in sensible forms to that which is divine, so the ancient priests, when they consider that there is a certain alliance and sympathy in natural things to each other and of things manifest to occult powers, and discovered that all things subsist in all, they fabricated a sacred science from this mutual sympathy and similarity. Thus they recognize things supreme in such as are subordinate, and the subordinate in the supreme, in the celestial regions, terrene properties subsisting in a casual and celestial manner.
It's actually causal.
Causal and celestial manner, and in earth celestial properties, but according to terrain condition. Proclus then proceeded to point to certain mysterious peculiarities of plants, minerals, and animals, all of which are well known to our naturalists, but none of which are explained. Such are the rotary motion of the sunflower, of the heliotrope, of the lotus, which before the rising of the sun folds its leaves, drawing the petals within itself, so to say, then expands them gradually as the sun rises and draws them in again as it descends to the west. of the sun and lunar stones and the heliocilius of the cock and lion and other animals. Now the ancients, he says, have contemplated this mutual sympathy of things, celestial and terrestrial, applied them for occult purposes, both celestial and terrestrial nature, by means of which, through a certain similitude, they deduce divine virtues into this inferior abode. All things are full of divine natures, terrestrial natures receiving the plenitude of such as are celestial, but celestial of super celestial essence. While every order of things proceeds gradually in a beautiful descent from the highest to the lowest, for whatever peculiar particulars are collected into one above the order of things, are afterwards dilated and descending, various souls being distributed under their various ruling divinities.
Okay, that's an awful lot there, and it's as above, so below is basically what the first part says. They recognize things supreme in that which are subordinate, and the subordinate in the supreme, in the celestial regions, terrene properties subsisting in a causal and celestial manner, and in earth celestial properties, but according to terrene condition. Yes.
Can you interpret that?
That's what we're... the best we can do is as above and so below. As it is on heaven, is it heaven, so it is on earth. That there is a correspondence. We learn by analogy and correspondence. There's a correspondence between that which is supreme and that which is terrestrial. The one is contained within the other. In the back corner.
And we think it's shown really well when you think about how the human body is formed. What is in the human body, what our cells are made of. We have electrolytes, we have minerals, hormones, everything. And everything that's in our bodies can be found in nature. And we know too that when there's a full moon, how the full moon affects humans, because we're so much water, and we know that the moon affects the tides. So there has to be, that shows what the connection is between nature and the universe and man. From the microcosm to the macrocosm.
And it talks about the naturalist. They know that there are mysterious peculiarities in plants, minerals, and animals, all of which are well known to naturalists, but none of which are explained. That's where we get, we observe, but we can't explain. We don't have the underlying basis for the phenomena. And then we don't know the nomina. We know the phenomena, but we don't know the nomina. And we do like the fact that it talks about the rotatory motion of the sunflower, the heliotrope, and the lotus. They follow the sun, and that we can observe with our eyes. Yes.
We've always loved in Transactions where Madame Blavatsky is commenting about the imitation in nature and how science will say, oh, this little insect does this for its own protection. It looks like something else, so the predators ignore it. And her comment is, really, don't you have to stand outside of something in order to see it? So that you can then make yourself look like that. And she goes on to explain it. It's all intelligence in operation. Everything we see in ourselves and in nature is an expression of divine intelligence within that form.
All is divine intelligence everywhere. It's we need to be the observer. Yes.
In the second paragraph, about in the middle, it says, all things are full of divine natures. Terrestrial natures receiving the plenitude of such are celestial, but celestial of super-celestial essences. So the comment earlier, the connection to nature, now we take it higher. It's also the connection to divinity that is within us.
Right.
And that might be the reference there.
Divinity would be super-celestial. It's that which is that which we cannot comprehend. That which it is. All we can say about it is it is. In the back.
So it's almost saying that we have to learn a language. Not the language that on this plane that everyone uses in different countries, different languages. This is something higher, something, maybe the idea of that symbols idea can explain it more, but we don't have that within our capacity now to express it.
Right, there's sound, number, color. There's an alphabet which needs to be learned, but it's not given out yet at this point. Some people naturally have certain abilities, but most of us don't. Yes.
About the moon, we know the tide and so forth. But there are certain plants that will not ripen only at nighttime under the moon. It's like peppers and eggplants and tomatoes.
Are they called nightshades?
Yes, nightshades.
Okay.
And it's also said that you should not sleep outside with the full moon. You're looking up at the moon. It has some kind of powers that we're ignorant of, but these like old superstitions and so forth, that the moon has a certain power to it. That's in fact why the Jews use the moon as calendar.
So there are beneficial aspects to the moon, and there are negative aspects as well. Yes.
So if there's magic going on all around us, what would Theosophy offer as a way to not get ensnared dark side, but rather keep to the divine?
Well, it goes back to motive again. It all depends on the motive. Is this for the good of all, or is this just for myself to gain some sort of power over others? To get somebody to buy something? In advertising, we see, they're working on our lower nature always. So if we only keep with the highest motive, we know that we're always safe. It all depends on motive. Yes.
If the sunflower and the lotus have innately these magical qualities, and as was previously said, we all innately do as well, how is it that I'm completely not only incapable, unaware? Last time I tried levitating a stone on my desk, I failed. Last time I precipitated an essay with a writing utensil, I failed. Last time I astrally traveled, I failed. So how is it that my knowing about these, incapable of climbing that mountain, where this magic, you know, I'm being told exists. But I'm a complete Neanderthal in all of this.
This magic exists, but I'm a complete Neanderthal. Okay. Well, the powers that you mentioned are the lowest powers of magic to begin with.
Can't start with the highest, can
it? No, we can. We can start from the highest. Yes.
And the highest powers of magic are mind, understanding, and compassion. And we definitely have to start with the highest. But why are we Neanderthals? Because we've used our powers in past lives improperly. And we've built up conditions where nature's protected from us. Our family is protected from us. The citizens around us are protected. Because we probably do have some powers from 18 million years of evolution. But we've been using them for ourselves. So we're blocked. And that's
right. Good. And there's a natural tendency to want to experience sensations and see so-called miracles and wonders. And it's part of our nature. It's a natural thing. But we're told to avoid that. Yes.
All we need to do is just pay attention. Perhaps we're trying to approximate what nature does through this false ego and only coming, you know, marginally close. And all we need to do is just watch what the magic that is being unveiled with every movement of the body, every breath we take, every, you know, bird that flies. I mean, there is magic everywhere and at every moment, and we're just not watching it because we're trying to create our own magic.
So it's, we're not watching the magic or recognizing it because we're trying to create our own magic. That's one way to put it. Yes.
Well,
go ahead.
Oh, thank you. And plus the question about, you know, why can't I do the meditation and whatnot, it goes back to motive, as the chair's been saying. And why would one want to do that? You know, and we're told not to force these powers, that we need to be patient because nature doesn't do anything fast, that we have to be patient and do your duty and meditate and do all that so that we can evolve to the point where these powers will come naturally to us.
So once we evolve and purify our lower natures, these powers will come naturally to us. Is that true? Or do we need to be initiated? Do we need to have a teacher in order to help us along the way? Yes, go ahead.
I wouldn't expect a teacher to come to a Neanderthal like me. But in response, or at least in the thought of why would we do this, why does a person climb a mountain? Why does a bird sing? These things, the bird doesn't sing for my edification. It sings because that's what it does. A mountain is there to be climbed because that's what it is. These powers are inherent in all of us. It's been said so. Is there evil in my attempts to understand them?
No, there's no
malevolent intention in any of this?
No, and we have free will. We can experiment with these powers, whichever you like. But there's just danger there. That's why there's a warning. That's why. Yes.
Well, I mean, in this physical world in which we live, we see our limits. Once we begin seeing ourselves as not this body, but as a spiritual being, and that we have another life that we live simultaneously while we live this physical life of a soul life. And the more we pay attention to that, the more we become I guess, purified in our nature. It's more that we live in that world of the soul rather than the world of this physical world.
Yes.
We were thinking, you said, you know, waiting for a teacher. Well, what are the books? I mean, if we're sincerely pondering a question or a problem, a book may fall off your bookcase and land at your feet. A friend may say something on the phone. You'll hear something in a class, and you'll understand for the first time. Everything and everyone is a teacher. If we're waiting for some great being to descend to give us anything, we're idiots, because that isn't how it's going to happen. We ascend. They don't descend. So if we're interested in astral projection, that's pitiful. We should be interested in helping starving humanity. Why climb a mountain when you haven't even plowed the field in front of you? It's just our motives are so twisted.
We wanted here to read the last paragraph because before the end of the class. So we'll have the last paragraph read at this time.
Evidently, Proclus does not advocate here simply a superstition, but science. For notwithstanding that it is occult and unknown to our scholars who deny its possibilities, magic is still a science. It is firmly and solely based on the mysterious affinities existing between organic and inorganic bodies, the visible productions of the four kingdoms, and the invisible powers of the universe. That which science calls gravitation, the ancients and the medieval hermetists called magnetism, attraction, affinity. It is the universal law which is understood by Plato and explained in Timaeus as the attraction of lesser bodies to larger ones, and of similar bodies to similar, the latter exhibiting a magnetic power rather than following the law of gravitation. The anti-Aristotelian formula that gravity causes all bodies to descend with equal rapidity without reference to their weight, the difference being caused by some other unknown agency, would seem to point to a great deal more forcibly to magnetism than to gravitation, the former attracting rather in virtue of the substance than of the weight. A thorough familiarity with the occult faculties of everything existing in nature, visible as well as invisible, their mutual relations, attractions, and repulsions, the cause of these traced to the spiritual principle which pervades and animates all things, the ability to furnish the best conditions for this principle to manifest itself. In other words, a profound and exhaustive knowledge of natural law. This was and is the basis of magic.
So we would ask, does one have to have a profound and exhaustive knowledge of natural law in order to perform magic? It says this was and is the basis of magic. Do we have to have that basis before we can perform magic? Well, we think we've already answered that in the class. That the answer is no. We wanted to read the fourth item from the 10 items in the start on page 587 in Isis Unveiled. Magic as a science is the knowledge of these principles and of the way. Actually, we should start. We need to start with the item above in order for it to make sense. Man is triune. He has an objective physical body, a vitalizing astral body or soul, the real man. And these two are brooded over and illuminated by the third, the sovereign, the immortal spirit. When the real man succeeds in merging himself with the latter, he becomes an immortal entity. Magic, item four, magic as a science is the knowledge of these principles and of the way by which the omniscience and omnipotence of the spirit and its control over nature's forces may be acquired by the individual while still in the body. Magic as an art is the application of this knowledge in practice. Arcane, item five, is arcane knowledge misapplied as sorcery, beneficently used as true magic or wisdom. So, there's the definition of the science of magic. And it does, for one, to consciously do it, we do need a profound and exhaustive knowledge of natural law. To consciously do it, and in a body, we need to accomplish this while we're on this earth and in these bodies. It can't be accomplished in the after-death states because they're effect states. Yes?
When I was young, I had a friend gave me something that was very magical. He gave me a pack of matches. Wondering how that this piece of material will light and a flame will be brought into this realm. And we always found that very interesting, if you consider that magic.
Well, it's but there are properties that are explained, that are known. It was magic to a child, but to a scientist, it's still magic, but it's understood. The principles are understood. Yes.
We've always thought the most incredible magic happens daily. I eat food, and somehow it knows to become bone, or muscle, or blood, or hair. I mean, there's magic going on within us at all times. We don't appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering if you can point to some of the richest sources of natural law.
The richest sources of natural law. Can we point to some of the richest sources of natural law? Yes?
Well, one that they mention here is attraction and repulsion. You know, that's part of the affinities of like attracts like is a affinity.
Yes. Sources.
Meaning like the secret doctrine?
Look, the Sermon on the Mount, the Bhagavad Gita, every devotional book is written on the basis of law and how you acquire power by not desiring power.
Ah, there's the paradox. We acquire power by not desiring it, by only desiring for others, which is altruism.
But some of the leading scholars. International law and the debate of super authority, which would be universal, from the past, looking at natural laws, looking at the nature of man, and then getting into more now academic veins to try and kind of reignite the older natural laws into looking to provide explanations for what's occurring in the world today, and this kind of desire to evolve in a more universal state of being. I was just wondering if there were any other resources that might support that.
In the back?
Yes, he says everything in the universe is subject to law, to the law of cycles, that there is an outputting and a return constantly, and that hopefully as we grow, when the cycle returns, we've got the new information to add to it, just as you were saying, to make that better each time as we go around.
Well, we need to stop at this point because it's the end of the hour. And we want to remind everyone that We are studying the Bhagavad Gita on Wednesday evenings. Class begins at 7:45 until 9 o'clock. And we will not be here on Sundays in August, but starting September 1st, we will continue with our studies in Isis Unveiled, and the topic will be Powers in Man and Nature. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Hi.
You got that?